Hello and welcome to episode 6 of series 2 of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with everything that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. I hope you're enjoying our episodes in this series of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. We are alternating, as you probably know now, between interview episodes 1 week and a shorter episode the following week, where it's just me sharing a few ideas and potentially some resources with you. If you've not already listened to our previous episodes, we've got all of them are available on our website, which is engagingic.com, but also on your podcast platform of choice. The one that you are listening to this podcast on now, you will be able to find them there. We have 30 episodes in season one, and as you know, with this being episode 6, we have 5 previous ones in this series as well. So if you've not already done so, I'd be really grateful if you could share this podcast with someone you know who might find it useful. It's a phenomenally successful way of growing our listenership. If everybody who listens to the show just shared it with someone else in their network or someone they know, maybe in their team or at work, who might find it beneficial, it's a great way for us to be able to grow our listenership and also to be able to attract some of the great interviewees that we are able to get on the show, which we're always amazed at the quality of our guests. So if you can help us with that, we can help you by getting more and more fascinating people for you to listen to. And we've got a really interesting interview for you today. Next week, it's a shorter episode. As I said, we're alternating. We haven't got an interview next week, but you'll be hearing me talking all about organizational values and how you can establish your organizational values and start to maybe evaluate them, which is something we're going to look at again in future episodes. Values is something we work with a lot with our clients, and it's something that crops up regularly in conversations and also projects that we work with. And the organizational values is obviously clearly a really important part of that engagement and comms mix that we are all working on. And then coming forward in the next few weeks, so just a quick taster of some of the interviews we've got coming up. We're going to be covering topics such as how you adapt your communications programs and your channels and where you are communicating with your employees during a crisis. And obviously we're going to be talking about the pandemic, but also what I would have been looking at there is how we can learn from that and about how we deal with crises in the future and how we need to adapt rapidly. We're also going to be looking at intranets as well in a future episode. We're going to be talking about are intranets relevant still? Do we still need them in our modern digitally connected world? And if we do need them, what sort of role do they fulfill? We're going to be looking at how you can communicate with employees in 24/7 operations or high pace environments, which I know we have quite a few people who listen to the show who work in those sorts of environments. Even if you don't, I think you'll find that a really interesting interview. We've got interviews coming up about employer branding and how that fits in with our culture and our whole communications and engagement mix. And we've also got an episode coming up about how you can use podcasting internally within your organization as a communication channel. So I know some of our clients do use podcasting. I'm obviously a massive fan of podcasting. That's why I'm producing this podcast that you're listening to. But I do think it's an underutilized channel within organizations. So I've got an expert who's going to be sharing with us some of the things we need to be thinking about if we are going to set up a podcast. And then we've got another interview that is coming up in a few weeks' time, which is going to be looking at the challenges of offline employees who aren't on the grid, aren't connected, don't necessarily have smartphones, don't have an email address. How do we keep them engaged and informed? And that's going to be coming up in future weeks. So if you want to know what's coming up in future episodes, the best way to do that is get on our mailing list, which you can sign up to at engagingic.com. And if you join our mailing list, we will let you know every week once the podcast is out what that podcast is about, and what's coming up in the following week's interview as well. So you will always know what is happening, when it's coming, and that will supplement any subscription you have to the show via your podcast platform of choice. Anyway, that's enough of that. On to today's interview.
In today's workplaces, there is quite rightly a focus and emphasis on diversity and inclusion. And this brings with it all sorts of challenges for communicators and employee engagers when we start to think about, okay, we want an organization with a consistent culture, we want consistent values that are lived and breathed across our organization, but at the same time, we want to identify and recognize that people want to bring their full selves to work and that we need to embrace that diversity within the organization. So I took the opportunity to speak to someone in today's interview who is working in an organization which is very diverse, both from a technical roles perspective, but also, but mainly from an international perspective. It's an international collaboration with people from across the world, from many different cultures, but we're working towards one common aim. So I thought that was a fantastically interesting opportunity to speak to someone who's working in that type of environment and find out what are some of the challenges that brings, but also how can you create that sense of inclusion and diversity whilst creating a sense of common purpose. And I think the lessons from this conversation will apply to your organization, regardless of whether it's multicultural or whether it's monocultural, but still very diverse. So I hope you enjoy it. So my interviewee today is Shira Tabajnikov. Shira is a stakeholder relations and internal communications manager at ITA, which is an intergovernmental organization established in 2006. Shira has been with ITA for nearly 3 years, and before that she held senior internal communications roles at the European Food Safety Authority and the European Science Foundation. Shira has many years of experience of leading communications in diverse and multicultural environments, and that's what we are going to be exploring today. So hello, Shira, how are you?
I'm doing very well.
That's great. And we're recording this in the latter stages of 2020, but this is going to be going out in 2021. So a very, very premature Happy New Year to you. And just let me let the listeners know where you're based, because you're in a very nice part of the world.
Yes, I am. I'm based in a place called Cadarache in the south of France. So it's not far from Aix-en-Provence. We're in the middle of nowhere with a lot of beautiful villages around us. So there could be plenty of space for the project for ITER where I work.
Yeah, fantastic, and that's a good lead into ITER itself. So I know it's a very interesting story about ITER. So do you want to tell us a little bit about ITER and what ITER does?
Sure. So ITER is an intergovernmental organization, but it's basically a huge laboratory where we're trying to actually build a sun on Earth. So it's very complex. And why are we trying to build a sun on Earth? Well, the project ITER is mainly trying to prove the feasibility of fusion. So fusion as a large scale and a carbon-free source of energy for the future to eventually replace fossil fuels. And fusion is based on the same principles that power the sun and the stars. But it looks easy for them, but to actually recreate this on Earth is incredibly challenging, because you have to also recreate the conditions that the stars and the sun have. So gravitational force, heat, the density of hydrogen, because fusion happens when you have hydrogen isotopes that are coming together. They're both positive, so they don't normally want to do that. So you have to have a really strong magnetic field pushing them together. And not only the same heat of the sun, but because we're on Earth, we're actually making it 10 times hotter than the core of the sun. So 150 Wow. million degrees need to take place in this machine that we're building, which is called Tokamak.
Wow. So anyway, that's that. I'd love to go into that, because I'm a scientist by initial training, and I'm really into anything to do with astronomy and stellar science. So, but anyway, that's not what we could probably go on about
when
well, yeah,
a little more normal.
when we're allowed to travel. Yeah, no, that would be absolutely awesome. So I know the key reason we're going to speak today is the fact that ITER is such a diverse project, and you are working with a hugely diverse group of people. And I wrote down a list of the different countries that are represented by ITER. So you've got the people, and I'm sure there are many more as well, but the People's Republic of China, the Republic of India, Japan, the Republic of Korea, the Russian Federation, the United States, and I would imagine a plethora of European organizations and countries.
The EU, yeah.
Yeah, so hugely diverse audience there. So, I mean, I guess without trivializing it, what are some of the challenges that you face with being an internal comms manager in such a diverse organization? If you could just maybe highlight some of those challenges.
35 nations involved. Yeah, it's very, very diverse, and it's really quite beautiful in that way because, you know, I think it. Some people say it might be more efficient if it were only one country that were working on it, but we're having components made, for example, with partnerships with Russia and China or with Japan and the EU, and having enormous magnets, for example, that are being shipped globally, larger. They're heavier than a Boeing 747 coming from Japan. And people won't ask us often, you know, why have you made it so hard on yourselves? But we really are seeking this international collaboration because it started out as a peaceful project between Reagan and Gorbachev in 1985, that they really wanted to do something peaceful with nuclear energy. So that means that we are very international. We've got about 40 different languages. We're covering about 85% of the global GDP. And so part of my job as the internal communications and stakeholder relations manager is to really raise an awareness of the intercultural differences that we might have and seek to smooth these out so that we can have a really efficient project management in place and that we can, in this really complex project, that we can hit our milestones and our deadlines because we really have no time to lose here and we don't want to lose it on tensions or misunderstandings. And there are a lot of cultural differences in the way that you approach complex projects. And of course, these happen in a lot of international organizations like, you know, the UN and other others that are equally diverse. But I think because we have such a complicated engineering project, we need to focus on this even more, I think, than other organizations.
And do you is there a obviously there's a huge diversity there in terms of culture and nationalities. Do you get a diversity of different specialisms as well? So you've got scientists, but I guess you've got project managers and a real diversity of different
of
job roles as well.
It's across the board. You know, you have diversity culturally, but also diversity in terms of scientists, the engineers, the type of engineers that we have, the project managers, the HR, you know, all different types of professionals as well in the way that they're used to working. You also have private sector and public sector coming in. So people coming to France, is that the France? So you're going to have cultural challenges and language issues. And then you come here and you just have to be up and running. So one of the things I was asked to do is induction to really help people when they come with an introduction of this awareness of what they might come up against when they're starting to work in a project and how they could adapt and not only just survive, but really thrive in this environment. And also see all the benefits that can come from working with people with different backgrounds.
So where do you start? I mean, you know, with an induction program like that, where you've got someone coming in, you know, literally, you know, fairly new into the country, new into the organization, and then faced with this kind of huge cultural diversity, mix of diversity. How do you sort of open up that conversation or that sort of learning for them?
We have a really nice induction program with a lot of trainings and introductions to ITER because we are rather complex. But what I do is give a workshop that combines something that I call intercultural awareness with the ITER values. So I think that these are, there's so much synergy in between these two things. We ideally would spend a week just on this alone. Yeah. I would love to do that, but I only have about 2 hours. And that's why it's really an introduction. And I think, you know, as you know, everybody knows it's this study, the behavioral change. You have to start with awareness. And that's the main objective of this induction. Many people who come to ITER are have international careers behind them. So they've worked in, most of them have worked in international settings, but they might not have really thought about it, what they could have done differently or what, looking back, reflecting what were some tensions that could have been handled differently or what are ways that you can leverage it even more in the future. So I like to focus on that.
And when we spoke, you spoke of you know, you've already started to mention the values there, around getting consistency around values. And I always, you know, from the work we do, I know it's even in a unilateral or uniform, you know, where not in a multilingual environment where we're just everyone speaking English, it can be difficult at times to get consistency around the meaning of a word, because often for values, there are the, you know, you could describe them as traits, they're clusters of behaviors rather than individual behaviors. And I know when we spoke in the pre-interview conversation a few weeks ago, you'd mentioned, you know, honesty can have so many different meanings in different countries, you know, in different contexts as well. So it would be really interesting, I think, because I think that relates, you know, regardless of whether listeners are in multinational context or whether they're just trying to get consistency in a kind of a uniform environment. What are some of those challenges that you face when it comes to, again, it's not just definition, it's meaning and cultural fit as well. How do you approach some of those when it comes to your values, and what are your values as well? Because you've mentioned that.
Well, that's are a lot of questions. So what I think is really interesting with the intercultural awareness and the diversity, just to start with that a little bit, is that when you look at, because I kind of have based my workshop that I give on three researchers that I think are really interesting. I think you can't get around Hofstede, who's, you know, the grandfather of it all. But I think Aaron Meyer and the Culture Map and Alan Molinsky, who's written Global Dexterity, are much more modern. They're much more what they talk about are dimensions that are really applicable to a professional setting. You know, things like giving feedback at your, you know, if you're very direct or if you're indirect, or the amount of enthusiasm you express, or formality, assertiveness, self-promotion. Those are things we can really relate to. So I usually start with just looking at what are some of these dimensions. But one of the shortcomings, I think, in some of these studies or these books that I've been reading and that I use are that they often focus on the differences. So you're looking at, you can do really interesting mapping of what's the difference between me, if I'm American, with my German and my Japanese colleagues in these different dimensions. And that will really help you become aware of where there might be some gaps, where you might want to adapt or make compromises. But it doesn't always help in terms of how do I adjust to an intercultural setting, to a team that's going to have people for not only one nationality, but a lot of people these days with globalization, with third culture, children and adults have multiple backgrounds. So this is what I find really challenging is talking about that type of setting. And what I've found it's really helpful is to create our own culture at ITER so that you're talking to people about how they can best adapt, but then you have to give them something to adapt to. It's not as easy as saying, oh, you're an American and you're going to go work in France. Well, then you should be careful of this, this, and that. And you might want to. No, it's not that simple. And that's already hard enough.
But, yeah.
You know, at ITER, we have people that that might be, you know, have two passports. Maybe they have an intercultural marriage or relationship. Maybe they've traveled around a lot, and then they come to ITER. So it gets really messy.
I guess there's a danger of you know, without inadvertently not deliberately patronizing them, but almost, you know, doing it, as I say, inadvertently, because they've already kind of got quite a lot of experience. And I think in those sort of situations, I've used Hofstede before, and I wasn't as familiar with the two others that you mentioned there. But I mean, I've used it before. I used to deliver a team building program on an international MBA program, which was, you know, kind of literally first week in, and they were all from all over the world. And I used to use it not as a, you know, you're from that part of the world, so you're invariably going to behave like that, kind of stereotype people. But just to say, there might be times where we kind of fall out over something that isn't anything to do with us. It's to do with it. We're looking at it from a different perspective. So just step back and think, am I looking at this just in a different way to you? And is that why we're not agreeing? Is it, you know, we're not fundamentally falling out about this. And it was just about that self-awareness, I think, more than, you know, people from Eastern Europe will always do this, and people from, from Far East will always, you know, it can be very, very kind of, I always used to struggle with the masculinity thing with Hofstede, because it was, how do you justify that? Because I just can't, you know, you're trying to make, it's science, but it's a really difficult one to try and justify. But
you have to be careful with the difference between stereotyping and generalizations, and I really do focus on it is peer-reviewed research that has a bell curve, and you're basically looking at when you have the results that say, oh, the French are like this or the Germans are like that. It's looking at well-researched, highly regarded findings that have been through peer review and have been published. So, course, you have the two ends where not everybody is like that. You know, you still have individuals. It just gives you some kind of framework to understand. And I also focus on understanding the context in many cases, the historical context of a country, for example, France or Japan, or older cultures that really have so much history of monarchies, of emperors, of so much that can help have played a role in why their behavior is a certain way today, or others, why they're flatter on a hierarchical level. And looking at the economic situation, which has a huge impact on the culture and on the value systems. You know, whether it's a culture where it's kind of more focused on surviving and it has a short-term focus, or cultures that have a strong GDP and allow them more space for thinking about democracy, thinking about tolerance, thinking about gender inequality. So I think understanding the context of behavior is really important, and that things like Hofstede or Aaron Meyer, Milinski's dimensions, those are a nice starting point to kind of help you think, well, what could these differences be? Why might they be there? How might my behavior be slightly different than this person? And then they also allow you a lot more empathy to understand, well, why might this person, for example, be less tolerant to certain things than I am, or be more uncomfortable with uncertainty than I am in this project? And those gaps and how you could maybe adapt it or understand it. I think empathy is truly the most important ingredient.
I agree.
Thriving. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And sadly, it seems to be in short supply and certainly in some quarters anyway, but I agree. And I think it, you're right. It's really interesting what you were saying there around using the Hofstede or whatever it is as a lens, and you know, I think taking that out of a multinational environment, you know, and even into a kind of more homogeneous environment, I think having that empathy of, you know, whether you're using a kind of a profiling tool or a behavioral profiling tool just to look at why, you know, my colleague might be really numbers orientated or detail orientated, I'm more big picture, you know, that means we'll complement each other and find, you know, different attributes to this thing we're working on, but we may not always agree that we're looking at the same thing, and that's fine as well. So,
that's also quite individual, but other things, I think like tolerance to certain things, that understanding why these might be different instead of from a cultural standpoint, instead of judging someone else as being intolerant as a person. I mean, having worked in Amsterdam, for example, where there's really a lot of tolerance for differences, gender equality, sexual identity, all of that. It's very open. It's all very accepted. It's the norm. I often start my trainings with looking a picture of a washing machine, and on the top of the washing machine is the word normal. And I'll say, yeah, there's the saying, I don't know who said it, but some say it was Whoopi Goldberg, but normal, that's only a setting on a washing machine. That's really the only place that normal exists. And, you know, reminding people of the bubbles that we live in and our unconscious bias and how, you know, we might think, for example, coming from Amsterdam, that it's normal to have this high level of tolerance. But if you're working in other cultures, maybe the Russian Federation, for example, China, Japan, that have slightly different attitudes due to their cultures, that's helps you empathize, understand, be less judgmental, try and find compromises and understanding when you're working together. And you asked me before about the values, so and what the
That's what I was going to say.
So what I was just kind of coming to that because I thought, well, if you're talking to people and you're saying, okay, you're going to have to let go of some of your own value systems, or you're going to have to adapt, it's nice to give them something to adapt to. So it's not so easy as saying you're an American in France, but it's more okay. Now you're at ITER, and what is our cultural code when you're here. So you might need to leave some of the things at the door. When you enter ITER, this is our culture. But what is our culture? And I think the ITER culture, we're building it. We're a rather young organization. So you need to start with your values, but also rituals. You need to build traditions, things that come around every year that people can expect is going to happen, or ways of doing things. So a few years ago, we came up with 6 values that were very much linked. We did this with the facilitator and the ethics committee, where there are representatives from all the different members. And we came up with 6 values, which are trust, integrity, loyalty, diversity, and...
It's always the test, isn't it? 6 is a lot to remember, though.
Team spirit is one of them as well. So, you know, we go through these and we think about, well, how do you, these are nice words, but how do you integrate them in your behavior at ITER? And are they really absorbed by senior management down to absolutely every level? And then, of course, you have the interpretations of values. And one of the examples I think I'd mentioned before was you could have one value that's, and they're all positive. All values are positive. So it's hard to say, no, I don't believe in that. It's more about prioritizing them. So I had a Dutch participant sitting with a Dutch man with a Japanese woman, and they were talking about the values that they thought were most important. And he said, honesty. To me, it's truly important to be direct at all times. It means I care and I'll give, you know, honest feedback. And the Japanese woman kind of diverted her gaze and she felt a little uncomfortable. And then she said, well, you know, I also believe in honesty. It's so important to me, but I don't know if I would ever say it in the same way. I don't know if it's really a sign of respect to always say what you think and to be critical, but I would do it in a slightly different way. And they had a discussion about the interpretation of that value and how it affects your behavior.
That's a lovely story. And I always remember I still do work internationally, but when I used to do a lot of international work and I love conversing with the Dutch because of that kind of honesty, the way you defined it there. And I remember a Dutch colleague who I was working with said, you know, the thing with you English, you always start with the paragraph and then you'll eventually end up with the headline. We always start with the headline and then we'll tell you the paragraph underneath. And I thought that's a really nice way of putting it. And yeah. It's true, you know, from my experience of working.
There's not a lot of soft language. So no, it's a good, very good thing to be aware of. If you go to Holland and you're working there and you're about to have your annual review, you might want to know, it's not just me. It's a kind of a cultural thing.
Yeah. Another favorite of mine was, I don't know if we'd only work with the Finns, the Finnish, but then they have a reputation for being quite, they don't really tell you very much. And I remember a guy, he was a Finnish guy to me, and he said, you can always tell a Finnish introvert, I can't really get this the right way around. You always tell a Finnish introvert because they look at their own shoes, and a Finnish extrovert will look at your shoes. And I just thought that was that's kind of self-deprecating, but interesting. So, look, I mean, you've talked a little bit about those values that you have, and you've mentioned there about leaving things at the door. How do you decide how do you allow people to decide what they leave at the door? Because getting that consistency about what people leave, because they may leave something at the door that actually you don't want them to leave at the door. How do you get that right? Because that I'm sure that's very complex and also quite subjective as well.
I think that's where the values can really, and that's why it's important that they're aware of them. One example for us is loyalty, which can be a bit controversial to talk about loyalty. What does that really mean? Why are we asking people to be loyal? And is it going both ways? But a lot of the people who come to ITER might be here just for a few years, and they might go back to their own countries to work in organizations there, or they might be coming from companies that have contracts with ITER, and maybe they're expecting to go back to those countries, or they might want to bring some colleagues or people they know to the ITER project and be on recruitment boards. So it's really, for example, loyalty is an important one for us to say. When you're here, it's all about the ITER project, and it might demand in some ways that you leave some of your former commitments behind you, that you don't think about your company getting the contract, or you don't think about if you're critical, for example, about an aspect of the project, that it might impact your future career going back to your country. So when you're here, you're here. Or for example, one example we had was whether to have an LGBTQ group at ITER supporting. Yeah. There was I think it was LGBTQ STEM Day, which STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. And there was a whole discussion whether this should be something that we're open about, that we allow at ITER with, having a group meet regularly and that's supported by the organization or not. And this is a really interesting discussion. And in the end, the ethics committee, although for some of them in their cultures, this was not considered quote unquote normal to have something like this. But in the end, they said, well, I'm not in my culture right now. I'm in the ITER culture. And one of our values is diversity and inclusiveness. So I think that here we should have this. So it was an instance where the values really helped with decision making.
Yeah, as values should. I think too often they're used as a kind of I'm being a bit kind of cynical here, but sometimes used as a sort of a, you know, we've done that, been there, done that, got the values on the wall. Whereas for me, if they're not driving better decision making or shining a light on the route that we want you to take when you're in those kind of trade off situations, then I think that they're not really doing the job they should be. So I think that's a really, really good example of, you know, someone potentially, and I guess it's, you know, compromising not only their values that they've probably cultural values they brought with them, but maybe even some of their own personal values as well, which absolutely. I think is a sort of real indication. And I guess that brings with it, all sorts of, you know, because for me, there's a whole thing at the minute, which I'm really interested in as well, which is about that sense of belonging, which is bringing your true self to work. And I think it's really interesting for me that it's not a paradox, I don't think, but the challenge of doing what you're doing, which I think is absolutely fantastic, which is allowing, you know, having consistency so you can, I mean, get just to function so you have that consistency, but at the same time, allowing people to be themselves and to represent themselves, but at the same time, not to use that as a way of trampling over other people's values. It's a really, I guess it's a, is it a fine line that you find you tread line. And you're always it's calibrating? Yeah.
And yeah. Well, you did touch on a really important word, which is cynicism.
Mm.
I think you're absolutely right that values need to be treated carefully and not as ticking the box. As soon as you have that attitude and people sense it, you know, they're not stupid. They're so alert. They're so bright and perceptive that, you know, if they feel that, oh, the company is coming with just these values and we have to take the box and they put it on the calendar, done. No, I mean, you really mm-hmm. have to have the biggest challenge is everyone needs to be a role model. So you have to get senior management as an example and talking about it and not just talking about it, but walking the walk and really showing that this is the way we do things around here. So that can be challenging. I think, especially in my role, I would say this as a caveat to anyone who's doing value trainings or been asked to do them. One of the things I refuse to do is to kind of defend senior management or be placed in that position where you go into staff and they might be critical and that you feel that you need to defend. Because then you're losing credibility. Then you're really seen. I've had someone say, well, I thought this would be a propaganda workshop, but in the end it wasn't. And I just loved that they went in there thinking, oh, more, this is going to be propaganda. And in the end, they felt that they were listened to, that there was some understanding of some of the challenges that they were facing, that they could talk openly. I always say it's a safe environment to have a discussion. And I won't repeat what they say. It's confidential. And that in the end, you can gather feedback that you delicately bring to senior management without revealing, you know, who said what, but that you kind of can report back and say, well, there are some concerns about this or with that. So I think it's a really delicate role that you have as a facilitator, as a trainer, when you're talking about intercultural differences and values. And you should never feel like you have to defend the senior management. It's more listening.
I agree.
Honoring and respecting staff's viewpoints. And giving them that space to air what they need to air. And that's really where the benefit comes in for the organization, not trying to go in there and tell them and defend behavior of people.
So one of the things I was going to ask you, and I'll just kind of think, I'm going to reframe it slightly. I was going to ask you, you know, how could we translate? So if someone's listening to this interview and they are not in a multinational organization, but however, you know, still very diverse, all organizations, all collections of human beings are diverse by their very nature. And I was going to ask you what they should do, but I'm going to kind of reframe it slightly to say, okay, so say you now you leave ITER at some point in the future once you've successfully created this sun on earth, and you go off to another organization, you know, by choice to work in an organization that's more homogeneous maybe than ITER is and less multicultural, but still, you know, has that inherent diversity. What have you learned from working in this sort of really, really richly diverse environment that you would continue to do in a more you know, air quotes, homogeneous culture where there's maybe not the cultural diversity, but there's still the sort of diversity that you get in human groups? What have you learned from this sort of experience that you've had?
That's a great question. I think what I keep learning every time I give these workshops is really believing in the I don't know how to say it, kind of the people that come to ITER are have such good intentions that most people, and I don't think I've even come across someone, most people have such good intentions. They just sometimes don't know how to channel it, or they're blocked. They don't understand why someone is different than they are. And I think culture is one aspect, but there are so many different things that make us different. And understanding how to help people overcome those things, work together with people with all different sorts of backgrounds and values, is really something I've learned so much by doing these workshops. The ability to just listen to them and hear it and give kind of nudges or give a little bit of an awareness of why that might be that helps them develop on their own. It's a skill that I think I've really developed at ITER.
Yeah. I really like that. I remember I did some workshops a few years ago for a client, and we did a whole thing around responding, you know, dealing they classed it as a high conflict environment, which I didn't particularly like that because it kind of, you know, kind of it's sort of prejudging it, but it was all around assuming positive intent. And we did a whole thing there, and there was quite an interesting TED talk that we used the video for, and we showed, and it was it was basically the premise was that if you always assume positive intent and act on the positive intent that you think that someone is trying to achieve, rather than responding to, it was basically that we often respond to a situation assuming that someone's having an attacking me, or they're having a go at me. But that if it was to flip that mindset to say, what is this person really trying to do that's positive, and how can I help them to achieve that? It meant that you responded in a much more way that was more likely to be disarming, but also more empathetic as well. And I kind of think that links through to that, which is we're all trying to do the best we can. You know, I won't remember what the quote is, but I think I don't know if you've ever read the book Snakes in Suits, but there's a small, very, very small percentage of people who are classed as organizational psychopaths who are genuinely malicious, but they're such a tiny percentage. Most people are just trying to do the best they can to get the best they can for a given situation. And if you can help them to do that in a way that doesn't cause damage, then you're doing a great job as a facilitator or a leader or whatever capacity you're working with them. So I think that's
giving me that assuming positive intent. I think that's really what I've seen. And and then also when people come to a place like ITER or wherever I might work in the future, it's they're often seeking a sense of purpose and meaning, and to find a way to as an internal communications person to remind them of that and to allow them to feel like they belong, that they have that the sense of purpose is real. They've come here. We need them. I think it's really very, very motivational.
And I think you've got a great story to tell. I mean, you know, that you're probably as aware as I am the kind of well-worn story of the NASA janitor putting a man on the moon or a person on the moon, and you know, you're creating a son on Earth. It's kind of pretty similar kind of league, you know. So you in terms of, you know, if people truly buy into that vision, then you know, I'd try to drop everything and come and help if I had some skills that were useful. It sounds like an amazing project. So I mean, you've got a bit of an advantage, I guess, there on, you know, absolutely, maybe organizations that have a more mundane purpose.
You're right. I mean, we are, the world is watching us, and we have a true purpose. And when we succeed, we really will. Yeah. Well, I think it will have a huge impact on climate change and on how we live on the planet. So everyone who comes here is pretty motivated by that already. You get here and you've been here for a while. Then you can hit a lot of challenges. The world is watching and the clock is ticking. So everyone's working really, really under pressure.
Not everything is as glamorous, I would imagine, as you know. You've got the kind of routines that have to be done that seem disconnected from, you know, that higher purpose. But definitely. So how far are you?
You just need to look out the window and have a lot of gratitude that we get to be in the south of France on the days when it gets hard.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How if you can tell our listeners, how far are you away? I mean, I know it's probably you don't have a definitive, but is the project, you know, is there some, I don't want to use the pun, light at the end of the tunnel, but you know what I mean.
That's a good pun. So yeah, we just started something called the assembly phase, where huge pieces of the machine are arriving from all over the world, and it's kind of like the biggest Lego in the world and the most complicated puzzle in the world. We're putting the pieces together, and we will turn on the machine for something we call first plasma at the end of 2025. So we will be able to see if this, is it working? Can we have a sustained plasma? And then for the next 10 years, 25 to 35, lots of different experiments will be taking place, so that we end with a machine that has net energy, which means this has never been achieved. I mean, there have been tokamaks, there are tokamaks in the world, but none of them have had put out more energy than they've needed consumed. To run. So we're looking for what we call a Q, so net energy of 10.
Right.
So that's what we hope to achieve. But I think really big news will be when we turn on the machine 2025.
Wow. Well, I'll be avidly looking out for that, and genuinely wish you all the success. I think, as you say, it's a truly transformational gets used a lot, but it's for sort of mankind and our species. I think it's essential, and the planet. So brilliant. So great. So look, that's been absolutely amazing, you know, both from a kind of what you're doing from an organizational perspective, but that the whole story that you've taken us through there. And I think, you know, for me, I've taken away some, you know, the importance of empathy, the importance of assuming positive intent, which we got to there, we were talking about there at the end, but also this for organizations that have got, you know, trying to translate values into one language or one culture. I think the importance of taking time to really sit down and have those conversations about how we interpret them, and also to understand the importance of alignment and how I think, you know, that you can have this duality, that you can have this, you know, I've got my own internal values, but when I'm here, I need to represent the values of the organization. And that's not in any way compromising my, who I am or my identity. And I think you've done that in a really, really sort of thoughtful and very, very kind of considered way, which I think is really, really fantastic. Anything from you really just to kind of sum up before we do the concluding questions?
Well, as I'm listening, I just wanted to mention what I think is really important in the workshops is not that I stand there and talk about the theory, which, you know, I've mentioned a few times, but also that we do role play, that we play games, that we look at cases and have discussions about the cases. So, you know, that's why these workshops require some time. You can't just go in and then do your PowerPoint presentation for an hour and walk out thinking that you've made a difference. So I really, this is one of the challenges of the pandemic, that, you know, now I'm doing a lot of virtual training, which is, it's okay. But what I do miss is the way that we would interact physically, which, because a lot of the intercultural differences are physical as well.
So
exercises, play, role play, games, laughing, vulnerability, all of that comes out more when you have a nice workshop together.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to mention those are important aspects of
no, success. Absolutely. And I took it as that. I think with this sort of thing, it has to be kind of experiential. And I totally agree with you. It's kind of trying to look through a keyhole and deliver a workshop through the keyhole is what I think, I feel, kind of video and technology is, particularly, as you say, something like that, which is very, you know, kinesthetic and you know, you need that sort of nonverbal communicative element to it as well. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. So look, look, Shira, I think you know this is coming. Well, I know you do because we mentioned it before. The question I ask all of my interviewees, which is even some of your colleagues who work with you quite well, or personal friends or colleagues, you know, outside of work,
but something that you do or have done, or something you're passionate about that not a lot of your closer people around you know. So what is it that you're going to share with us today?
Well, okay, it's not necessarily a huge passion or something confidential, but something I'm a bit proud of that I think is metaphorical of what I think is important is when I got married in 1998 and had my first child, it was in Amsterdam. And it was the first year that there was legislation that allowed the children to take the mother's name.
Okay.
And not automatically the father's. So it was a choice. And then if you had more children, the only rule was that they all had to have the same last name.
Yes.
So I thought it was really beautiful because it's so much of what I believe in and kind of challenging the role patterns that we have in couples and in parenting and all of that. That my husband, who's Dutch and I'm American, I think it also says a lot about the Dutch, that he, with the last name Smit, said, you know, sure, there are enough Smits in the world, and Tabachnikov is a beautiful name, and you only have sisters. So the name was going to die out with my generation of my sisters. So he said, let's give the kids the last name Tabachnikov. And soon after that, I've had two more. So there are a bunch of Tabachnikovs added to the group. And it's also, at a certain point, he also said, Shira, you know, you love your career and you're working really hard. He ended up really raising the children and I worked full time, which even in the Netherlands, which I think is a very open, tolerant, country, even at that time, only 3% of the couples there had that model where the mother was working full time and the father was taking care of the kids full time. So I think today I see it more, but at the time it was quite unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, 22 years ago, it wasn't, I mean, in the UK, certainly. But yeah, I mean, even in a liberal country like Holland, that's it's nice. It's really nice. And yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, Tabachnikov is much more interesting than Smith. That's brilliant. Well, thank you for sharing that. No, it's a lovely story. And 1998 was my son's first child. My son was born, so it's a special year for me as well. So,
anyway, it's a good year. It's great.
Well, look, it's been absolutely brilliant speaking to you. Fantastic to hear about the work that ITER's doing, and particularly your work as well. If anyone wants to reach out to you, I normally put my interviewee's LinkedIn URL into the show notes, if that's all right. If anyone would like to sort of communicate with you, is that all right?
Yes. Absolutely. Anyone can contact me for more information on this and also about ITER. And I'd like to give you a special invitation to come visit when it's possible. And we'll give you a tour of the place. And
a VIP tour. Really, you won't need to ask twice. I'll be looking at flights. Not that there's any available probably at the moment, but no, I definitely take you up on that. I am fascinated by anything to do with this. My wife despairs of me watching National Geographic and the cable TV channels about anything to do
with. Bring her along, and you'll be able to. she'll understand your passion after she's
definitely.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Definitely. Well, that is a very, very kind offer, Shira, and I'm very grateful, and I will definitely take you up on that, and hopefully we'll keep in touch in the meantime as well. So, well, look, we are recording this before Christmas, so I am going to say Happy Christmas, but as it's going to go out in the new year, also a very happy 2021. Lots of success for you and ITER going forward this year, and hopefully quite not as bizarre a year as we've had in 2020, I hope, and I wish you and your family all the best for this coming year.
Thank you. Same to you. Let's hope that 2021 has some nice surprises in store for us.
I hope it does too. Take care, Shira. Thank you.
You too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Ideally, everyone in your organization would be on the same page. They'd be facing in the same direction and towards its vision and goals. However, in today's fast-moving world, as we all know, it can be really hard to get employees to see the big picture. For example, what are we aiming for? How are we going to get there? And how does my role contribute? When your employees don't see the big picture, they can make the wrong decisions. They may feel less of a sense of belonging, and they may not fully contribute towards your organization's objectives. So how do you consistently put large numbers of people in the picture in a way that helps them understand what your organization is trying to achieve, but also do that in an engaging and effective way? At the Big Picture People, we combine visualization, discussion, and interaction to fully engage your employees in the organization's big picture. We create light bulb moments for your employees, and we bring your values, your strategies, your objectives, and your change processes to life in a really rich, clear, and visual way. We also show your employees the complexity of the world that you're operating in and how their role contributes towards organizational priorities. So if you see the value of putting your people in the picture, head across to thebigpicturepeople.co.uk and book a free 30-minute consultation call via the link on our homepage. So thank you for listening to Engaging Internal Comms. Hope you found this episode useful. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts about the show. So, and also any questions or ideas that you've got for things you'd like us to cover in future episodes. So you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us via the contact form on our website, which is engagingic.com. Also, you'll be able to sign up for our mailing list there, and we'll send you relevant news about the show, new episodes, and also anything that we think you might be interested in when it comes to internal communications or employee engagement. If you like the show and you haven't already done so, please subscribe to it via your podcast service. And also you can subscribe to it via the links on our podcast page, which again is engagingic.com. If you know anyone else who might be interested in the show, please distribute it to them. Please let them know about it. We want to try and grow a community of people here who are contributing to the show, giving us new ideas for episodes and things that you'd like to cover in future. So thank you very much.